Thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to be able to follow Carmody's talk, which has just got my mind thinking about so many things. But what I do want to do, at least, is give some sort of perspective in my everyday life, really, as a teacher and as a conservation scientist, in terms of how we or how the world is understanding the ecological crisis that we're in, but also what motivates people or not to actively be involved in nature conservation, and where Christianity fits in to all of that too, because the reality is most of the students who I interact with don't come from a Christian background at all and have no concept or understanding of the very things that we've spoken about. So so very much in that context, I'm just going to give you some examples of my everyday life, really, and how I interact with students to think about beliefs and values and why that's important, particularly in the conservation world that they're hoping to move into. So I'm basically going to start with a very brief overview of the state of the planet, and in particular just to provide the current paradigm that the international scene is working in, and how values fit into that very much. I'm then going to talk again about why belief matters, following on very much from what Carmody was saying. And then revisit this idea of this this biblical stewardship environmental ethic, which actually, until quite recently, did explicitly form the basis of our international nature conservation movement. And it's all in the textbooks that I use with my students as well. So, you know, we're not trying to reinvent something, we're just trying to say that it's a historical truth that our international conventions that we currently have and are still in operation are underpinned by this ethic. So actually, Christians have got something to say, and it is important for us to understand that and to revisit that in the current paradigm. So my starting point, really, sort of at the turn of the millennium, the United Nations commissioned a study to basically examine the state of the planet. You know, so 2,000 years AD, what was the planet like? What was the state of it? What was the state of the ecosystems? And how can we take stock as we begin to sort of look forward into the future? And as a result of that, we had this introduction of this value-based system called ecosystem services. And this is very much a term which describes the benefits that people obtain directly from ecosystems. So it's very much an anthropogenic approach to how and why we should be protecting the planet. And the arguments for why we've moved into this area was very much because nature isn't taken into account in most of our global economic models or thinking. There's just an assumption that we live in a world which is infinite, and that there are resources that any corporation or individuals can tap into and use for their own benefits. And so the argument very much was that our traditional approaches for wanting to protect nature weren't working. And so we needed to change the narrative to bring us to a point where the decision makers and the policy makers could understand. And that sort of bypassed you and I as individuals, as families, as churches, very much to the focus to what the decision makers, i.e. the bean counters, could understand. Because up until that point, it was just not taken into account in any way. And so what we had was this exercise where we began to classify how ecosystem services were defined. So, example, you might have a supporting service, which is nutrient cycling, soil formation, primary production, and so on. Provisioning, so nature provides us food, fresh water, wood, fiber, fuel. Regulation, so climate regulation, flood regulation, disease regulation, and so on. And this final ecosystem service classed as cultural. So if you notice at the bottom in that, we've got what's called spiritual services. So there was a recognition, at least, that people valued the world for a whole range of reasons, including spiritual, which is a really good way to kind of shove in global religions and thinking. But interestingly, what's happened, at least in the UK and the Western context, is that these cultural services tended to be completely overlooked. And I'll come back to that in a moment. So the whole idea was that by classifying these ecosystem services, we could then start linking that to what are called constituents of human well-being. For example, how does the natural world begin to map onto these important things in terms of our security, basic material for good life, i.e. shelter, nutritious food, and so on, and how it maps onto health. And in fact, much of the research agenda over the last couple of decades has been very much on mapping these sorts of services. So within the media, we now know the importance of insect pollinators, for example. That's one area where I think people's attitudes towards the decline of bees has worked. So people now say, well, losing bees is important because we lose pollination, and pollination is important for crops. So it is an outworking, if you like, of this ecosystem service approach. And the links between human health. So there's lots of studies now saying access to green open space is a major contributor towards people's mental health. So, you know, the further we remove people from the natural environment, the higher incidence of a whole range of mental health issues. So in other words, being in nature, scientifically, we've shown that that's really beneficial. And so you now have the NHS spending a lot of money trying to find ways of getting people back out into nature. So the point is, although these mapping exercises have gone on, we just need to be aware that there are some good sides to it, as well as some bad sides, which I'll come back to in a moment. And one of the reasons why we need to consider this is that the state of the planet at the moment is rather dire. But we've got another 2 billion people coming by 2050, so within my lifetime. And global food demand is expected to more than double in that time too. So we have some real urgent issues and pressures facing us as a species on the planet, and how we're going to deal with that going forward. And the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment also started to map out what were the drivers of change. So you probably can't see, but effectively down this area here, we've got a range of biomes from forest through to mountain. And then across the top, we've got drivers of change that could be habitat change, climate change, invasive species, pollution, and so on. And the different colors represent the impact on biodiversity over the last century. So the red and the oranges represent high or very high impact. And then what we've also got are these arrows showing the current trends of those drivers too. And essentially, you'll see there that all of them are pointing, I think with the exception of one, in an upward direction. So there's real pressures on the planet and the state of our current ecosystems. And more recently, you would have seen 2 weeks ago that the UN IPBES report was published. And there's a whole range of headline news stories, such as this one, which I'm sure many of you would have seen, whereas humans threaten 1 million species with extinction. And there's a lot of debate amongst my conservation friends as to how useful actually it is to have these sorts of headline figures in trying to cajole people into taking biodiversity loss as a significant issue. And although I haven't had time to read the report from cover to cover, I've pulled out a couple of graphs, which is basically moving 20 years on from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, what the current global assessment is. And we can see just some of the statistics down on the left-hand side, whereas 47% of natural ecosystems have declined on average relative to their earliest estimates. 25% of species are threatened with extinction. 23% of ecological communities, the integrity of the communities and the abundance has declined by 23% on average. The global biomass of wild animals has fallen by 82%. The global biomass of wild animals, mammals, has fallen by 82%. So we've essentially replaced animal life on Earth with a growing human population. And 72% of indicators developed by indigenous peoples and local communities show ongoing deterioration of elements. And so here is the graphs produced looking at the current state of the extinction risk of a whole range of different organisms around the world, through fish at the top, all the way down to corals and so on, towards the middle and bottom. And again, what we can see here in the dark red are the critically endangered species within those groups, bearing in mind that many of them haven't been assessed to any level of detail. And the orange represents endangered and so on. And this is really where the scientists have come up with this estimate, which are the blue lines of the percentage threatened, and come up with the calculation that a million or so species are threatened with extinction. And so there have been a whole range of other headline-catching stories, such as Insectageddon. So there's a range of studies around the world which have shown that insect populations have virtually collapsed, even in areas where there is no human interaction or modification of the environment too, which goes to show again that what's happening at the global scale can have significant impacts on the local scale as well. So the point is that we are very much in an ecological crisis, and we are seeing the destruction of ecosystems. And one of the things that I do as a scientist is I'm a network ecologist, so I use network science, complexity science, to map the direct and indirect interactions of all organisms within a system, of which humans are embedded within that network. And one of the things that we study is the extinction dynamics. So if you start knocking different species out of the system, you can calculate what we call the robustness or the cascading effects of losing those species. And the point is, there's only so much perturbation an ecosystem can take before it collapses. And what we're seeing are examples around the world of where that's beginning to happen and things unfold. That has implications for us because we are a part of that network. So the interconnectedness of all things can be studied and helps us to think about our place in creation. And so what you get are a whole range of commentators which say all sorts of alarming things. For example, there's Jack Skirk there. Our survival is no more than a question of 25, 50, or perhaps 100 years. Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, human beings only have a 50-50 chance of surviving the 21st century. James Lovelock, who even termed the word ecosystem, before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable. So again, all sorts of apocalyptic language, really, and lots of concern or even sort of resignation, actually, that that the current way that we live on the planet is like an unstoppable juggernaut, and the outlook doesn't look good, particularly in a world with 2 billion more people and all of the uncertainties of climate change. So ecologists tend to be accused of being the cartographers of doom, so I hope I've done my job, at least so far, in presenting the data that we have and the state of the planet. But if that is the case, well, is there any hope? If you have people who are very high profile, who just sort of seem to think, actually, we're in the end times, this is where we're going, maybe it's actually a sign of the end times too, so let's just eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And so again, just sort of bringing it in terms of people's values too, within the IFES report, the whole reason why we need to be moving now is so very anthropocentric. So it's all about nature's contribution to people, whether that's habitat creation and maintenance, pollination, seed dispersal, regulation of air quality, and so on. And I'm not sort of really here to debate the pros and cons of those sorts of approaches, but we need to bear in mind that the paradigm has moved away from protecting nature for its intrinsic value, which is what the conservation movement originally was all about, towards focusing nature around its contribution to us directly as people. And this has all sorts of pros and cons. So at university, I have a whole range of zoology and biology students. Some specialize in ecology as well. And at the start of every year, we get given some tutees. And I meet with my tutees, and I say to them, my first question is, why should we protect the planet? Why is it important that we care for the planet? And for most of them, it's because we might find some medicine, for example, in the rainforest that might be useful for curing diseases. For others, it might be that we are dependent on it for air and clean water, and so on. And what I find is very often people tend, or the students tend, to sort of state these sorts of reasons as to why we should be caring for the world. And then I ask them, why are you choosing to do a degree with a focus on conservation biology? And for them, that's really difficult. It's one of those, for anybody who lectures, it's one of those tumbleweed moments where you sort of sat, there's an awkward pause. But the point is that I find it interesting that one, nobody's ever really asked them that question. And secondly, for many of them, they can't actually articulate the reasons why they want to do it. But apart from liking David Attenborough, for example, and being inspired by some things that they've seen on the TV. But the point is that they are motivated and they can't articulate it. And maybe that is through to do with issues of justice, for example. But maybe it's actually through love. Maybe they love birds. Maybe they really love the natural world. Maybe there's something much deeper within them, which is, for the want of a better word, spiritual. That there's something much deeper that they can't articulate. And so I try to explore those sorts of questions with them, because I think it's really important, if they are going to be successful conservation biologists, in the future. Because not only do they need to understand their motivations, they need to understand the motivations of the people who they're going to work with. Many of them want to work overseas, cross-culturally. There's no point in parachuting a Western-trained scientist into rural Indonesia, for example, unless they can understand people's beliefs and values. And in my experience, at least, beliefs and values tend to be off-limits, certainly within this country and certainly across Europe, less so in other parts of the world. But quite why belief has become off-limits, I find really quite disturbing, because actually we do need to understand these if we are going to be successful in turning around the ecological crisis. And the danger is that if we don't do that, then we will go down the route of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment approach of valuing nature by purely putting a financial value on it. So, for example, there was a study a few years ago on a coffee-producing farm, and a lot of our coffee crops are under attack by particular types of pests. I can see a few academics getting a little bit uneasy about the idea that there might be any coffee in the future. But the point is, there are these birds which will actively predate on many of these pests and provide an ecosystem service. So again, we don't value the bird for what it is, but actually we value it because it provides a service. And in this particular study, they found that these birds were worth $310 per hectare by providing a natural form of pest control, and without the bird, then they would have to spray, which is more costly. And even here in the UK, we had our own mini version of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment called the UK National Ecosystem Assessment. And within that, we put a value on wild pollinators, contributing about £500 million to the UK economy each year. So, you know, I use these as examples because if we are going to adopt an ecosystem service paradigm, then ultimately, in our country at least, we can only really articulate value in economic terms because everything else is off limits. And so as a result of that, people become really deeply unhappy knowing that a robin might be worth 10 pence in their back garden. It doesn't resonate with people, and it's certainly not a motivator, in my experience, at least with my students, of them getting out of bed in the morning and wanting to fight for a better world. But nevertheless, this is the world in which we live, and it's within the UK Treasury, it's within the speak of all the economists. Again, I'm not going to talk about the advantages and disadvantages of this approach, but what I will do is say just what this means for myself working in this field and for the students who I work with too. And there's this quote by Georges Monbiot, who is a really fierce critic of this whole idea of natural capital and how we value life on Earth. This quote here, he says, "Rarely will the money to be made by protecting nature match the money to be made by destroying it. Nature offers low rates of return by comparison to other investments. If we allow the discussion to shift from values to value, from love to greed, we cede the natural world to the forces wrecking it." And so what I love about that quote, and regardless of what you think of Georges Monbiot and his approach to rewilding and many other things, is that he acknowledges at least that he can articulate that the reason why he wants to protect the natural world is because he loves it and is motivated by love. And if that doesn't resonate with Christian thinking, then I think we've missed the mark a long way. And the point that I make with my students as well is that our beliefs do affect our actions. And we need to accept the fact that most people across the world, over 80%, have some sort of religious belief. So even though we don't see it perhaps here in the UK, It's very apparent for any of you who have lived or worked in the global south. And so here's a great example from an Indian bird reserve. In the next incarnation, you might be an endangered species. Help us save the Siberian crane. Please do not trouble the bird. Do not try to get close. Watch from a distance. Do not make loud noises. Respect the bird. But again, I use this slide with some of my students as well. So how we value and see the world does affect our actions. And many of the landscapes that we see are also the outworking of people's religious beliefs. And whether we like that or not, we just have to accept the fact that that is the case. And the biodiversity that we have associated with that is also a result of how humans have been interacting with the world. And I say, this is a photo from an oil refinery just off at the edge of Hull, where I used to live. And presumably, because if we want to drive cars and have mobile phones and have all the sort of material possessions that we've grown to become so attached to, maybe this is a price worth paying, right? So maybe we just pollute the environment. The point is that it's driven by our belief and actions, and we just need to try and make those connections as individuals and as communities. And so what I find really unsatisfying in some of the biological conservation textbooks for my undergraduates is when you look, there are some attempts at least to look at the incentive for biodiversity conservation. And this is one from Andrew Pullen's book on biological conservation that I've just pulled out, where I said that, you know, the incentive may be material, i.e. It just benefits us directly, maybe existential, strengthens the relationships of humans with the rest of nature and so on. It may be heuristic. The point is that a lot of these tend to be deeply unsatisfying in helping people, I think, to articulate in a more deep and holistic reason why they do nature conservation and why we should be involved in it too. And just as an aside, conservation biology as a sub-discipline of biology is regarded as a mission-based discipline. Okay, so mission is at the heart of it. And we get lots of students taking part because they want to be part of the mission. There's something upwelling within them that wants to be part of it, even if they can't articulate it. And so it shouldn't really come as a surprise to us that there's a whole range of religious denominations around the world who are actively involved in biodiversity conservation. One that I've been involved with very much is Arosha, Christians in Conservation, and I have a few quotes from the co-founder of that I would like to speak about in a moment. The point is that there are religious outworkings of the ecological crisis in terms of how they want to respond. But if we're honest, and given the criticism that we've had of people like White and others in the past, and more recently David Orr, is that, you know, Christians have been late to the show. You know, why has the church dragged its feet on something which Carmody has said right at the beginning should be very central to what motivates us as Christians? And so in terms of some correspondence that I had with Peter Harris from Arosha, currently the president of Arosha, particularly with this whole idea of ecosystem services and how we value the world, I just wanted to read this bit of text. I'm sorry, it's a little bit long, but I think it gets to the heart of the problem and helps us in our understanding of how we might progress going forward as individuals and hopefully as the global church. But here he says, there is certainly a troubling disconnect between the secular West and the global South, where biodiversity is concentrated. It's potentially problematic because where conservation funds are raised and decisions are made in the West, and let's be honest, the most funding for nature conservation is generated in the West, beliefs are regarded as personal, and so they remain unexpressed. Whereas in the South, where there is a more seamless and easily expressed conversation between action and its faith motivations, important motivations for conservation could go unregarded by conservation professionals arriving from another world. So I have a real pleasure and honour to be able to work in Indonesia, in Argentina, in Brazil, and Tanzania. And one of the things that I find there is that it's really easy to talk about your faith and your beliefs. And in fact, it's almost encouraged. Even if there are some divisions between Muslims and Christians in parts of Indonesia, for example, but we can talk about it. Whereas I think here, even in the UK, even within a university context, a lot of the time you're just laughed out of the door. And that's my personal experience. But what he does say is that I do believe there are encouraging signs. And paradoxically, it is the realization that conservation itself is inevitably a religious experience, even for secular people, that it's moving this forward. I mean by this religious with a very small r, but in the sense that it is an expression of convictions that are not exclusively empirically derived at least. And it is the profound struggle to establish a value for nature that I think is driving it. And so the point is, even amongst my students, I can begin to talk about whether the valuing of nature and the paradigm that we're currently in of assessing the ecosystem services provided to people directly. Is that actually right? And is that enough? And inevitably, they come to the conclusion that it's something, it's a tool, but nowhere near is it enough to scratching that itch for why people are getting involved in this. And so what that means is actually that there are moves by a range of faiths around the world. So this is a news article from a few years ago where WWF hails Indonesia that fatwa against illegal hunting and poaching of animals. So, you know, you do see religious groups beginning to sort of take this whole issue seriously and try to sort of feed that through in how they think and act. So it's a classic example of where religious belief does matter. And then just sort of before I finish as well, is that what we do need to remember, and this is just taken straight out from a conservation biology textbook that I use with my students as well, is that the conservation movement is built already on what we can regard as a biblical stewardship environmental ethic. And it is still, I think, one of the dominant worldviews in the world. It still influences current thinking. And the point, we mentioned the word intrinsic quite a lot already, but on the intrinsic value of species, this ethic speaks without equivocation. So in other words, it takes this whole idea that nature is here directly to benefit humans and puts it in a much more biblical context, which I think actually we need to regain. Again, this is one of the textbooks that I give to my students. So, you know, it's not as though the conservation biology approach for me as a Christian is a way of talking to students, to the majority of people who I interact with who aren't Christians, as to why perhaps we should take faith seriously in a faithless world. And the biblical basis in our textbooks that are available to students around the world points to these various ideas that Carmody mentioned right at the very beginning, and points to this whole kind of biblical basis of why we should do it. So, you know, it's not as though I can even be accused of trying to bring Christianity into a world that has rejected Christianity. The point is, it's an historical truth that actually this has formed the environment ethic, which we should still be trying to develop and apply further. And just to say as well that, you know, in terms of what can we do and where are we moving, well, there are people involved in a whole range of really, really good and important work around the world, as articulated by the Sustainable Development Goals. So whenever I give a talk like this, it can be sort of really negative when we see the environmental crisis ahead of us. But there are really good, loving people around the world who are involved in trying to find remedies and solutions to this. And we should be doing much more as churches, I would say too. So within the IUCN, the World Conservation Union, there is one Christian organisation within that, which is Arusha. And actually, why aren't we stepping up to the mark and being involved so much more in caring for the planet? And finally, this is just a quote from a friend of mine who is Simon Stewart, and who used to be the chair of the Species Survival Commission for the IUCN, and a Christian. And this was a paper that we had co-authored in response to a criticism of the church by David Orr a few years ago, where we've already spoken about the criticism of Christianity in terms of the misunderstanding and application of the word dominion within Genesis. David Orr's criticism is very much about eschatology and this whole idea of actually it's going to be burned up, why should we care, and how that influences some right-wing evangelical thinking. But this is his own personal reflection as somebody who's been committed to global nature conservation around the world. And he says, Christians are committed by their biblical beliefs not only to the conviction that God himself cares for his universe, his cosmos, in a daily and ongoing way, but also that he helps and guides people in their conservation efforts. So he feels very much the presence of God in his day-to-day interactions in what seems like a hopeless fight. He says, we are therefore not on our own against the relentless forces of unsustainable development and rapacious materialism. Every time we celebrate a conservation success story, such as the recovery of the white rhinoceros in southern Africa, we are strengthened in this present hope that God is working with us to redeem his creation. And I think, again, if we can begin to grasp this idea that on the daily interactions that we have and the actions that we do as individuals and as groups, not only will we experience God's presence with us, but actually we can be those instruments of peace working towards redeeming his creation.
Thank you very much. As we earlier stated that we were willing to flex a little bit on the timetable, I reckon we could take 5 minutes at this point before going into lunch, and then are you around over lunch or something?
Yeah, maybe.
So, yeah, so let's have a couple of really succinct questions if possible, and we'll see where we get to. David first, or sorry.
I was interested in what you said about some of your colleagues are doubtful about the headlines, million species due to extinction, you know. This almost mirrors the developments within the climate campaign over recent years. Up until 2009, up until Copenhagen, it was Stop Climate Chaos, that was the national coalition. Well, we moved away from that after then, and it was putting people off, we thought. Mm. So we had the Climate Coalition and, you know, Care for Things We Love, ever since. Now, of course, in the past year, that extraordinary phenomenon, like a diminutive reincarnation of the Old Testament prophetess Deborah, Greta Thunberg, has come up. And of course, what she says to people, what she said to the financial elite in Davos was, the house is on fire, you know. too far gone now to do anything other than state the truth. And it's interesting that the exile principal demand of exile on their boat in the middle of London was tell the truth. I offer this as my own reflection. Can I just say, what I haven't heard from Althea, from you, is, I understand, and of course I'm fully committed to the idea of redemption of creation, of its abolition, and so on. But what I haven't got and the theological implications of that, and the practical ones, what I haven't got is how I view, in my daily campaigning work, the collapse that we're involved in. I haven't got a framework in which to incorporate that and with my own.
So, arguably, this is one of the reasons why certainly many people within the conservation movement have used a natural capital ecosystem service approach. Because unless we can demonstrate to, and I think the question is, who is it we're trying to demonstrate this to, actually? The whole idea is that if we can say, actually, by degrading X, Y, and Z, this is going to have cascading impacts on us, then it just seems that there doesn't seem to be the political will to make those changes. And I interact with a lot of farmers across Europe, and I ask them, what are you doing to prepare for the impacts of climate change? And for most of them, nothing, have no plans. And then when you start talking about what you're going to do in terms of the impacts of flooding, then it becomes a currency that they understand and they do take seriously. So on the one hand, I think the conservation movement are trying to provide information in a way that might stimulate people into changing. But if I'm honest, a lot of the stuff that I presented now, I was being taught as an undergraduate many years ago. And we've known this for decades. And how much more does the science community need to point out the urgency of the issue before we act? And I don't just mean governments, I mean individuals, and I mean churches too. So for myself, I find myself constantly on the one hand, the edge of the church and the edge of wider society. And I see some decisions made in the church which I just sometimes have my head in my hands, if I'm honest, and just think, is it that we're just saving souls, before the final breakdown? Or is it actually, no, there is a chance to respond now, and we can do something about it. Whilst on the other, I'm faced with people who just point out the rejection of climate science, evolutionary biology, which comes from what they see as Christians and Christianity. And I just find myself stuck in between that. But maybe the way we do respond to that, actually, is to take our faith seriously. So, we're very good at holding badges and saying, I'm a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, or whatever. But why don't we take it seriously? Why don't we take the very things that the Carmody was talking about seriously and see that permeate through our lives in all things that we do, instead of some other form of superficial Christianity, which is what we often encounter a lot of the time.
Thank you. As Carmody was implicated in that question, I feel it's unfair to ask her if she'd like to comment.
Very quickly, it's really important, the issue you raise, because we need to process not only environmental responsibility, but also environmental grief and environmental loss and the consequence of sin. And I think we're at an early stage of that. Actually, I've just had a just got my first doctoral student who will be working directly on this issue of understanding how theologically and biblically and spiritually we process what's actually happening, not what we hope should be happening. Everybody's doing lots of ethics, but actually grappling with the consequences of what we are and have become. Just something very brief on that, that this work has yet to be done, so I don't have a huge amount to say, but I think there's a really interesting strand of thought in the Hebrew scriptures particularly, which understands what happens in the natural world as manifesting divine judgment. And this we might want to discard as a kind of supernaturalistic, out of date, etc., etc. Actually, it's incredibly contemporary. The fact is that what's happening to the natural world, as you just very movingly described, is God's judgment. You know, this is one of the ways in which we get, as it were, divine feedback. This is a kind of, we are unraveling the pattern that we were given to sustain. And you know, in the New Testament, they have this lovely and scary metaphor of sin as being a handing over, when God hands people over to the consequences of their sin. And that's really what's happening. You know, we are just handed over to the effects of what we've done. And there's a very appropriate grief, and I might almost say penance, you know, an attempt to kind of really come fully to acknowledge and face the consequences of what we've done and not to hide from it. And that's got to be a kind of central part of spiritual, liturgical, etc. practice. Christians are very good at talking about sin and breastfeeding and all the rest of it, but it needs to be more focused on the actual practical outworkings of that, which includes poverty and injustice to our neighbours on the planet, and also the destruction of non-human life. Incredibly quickly, there is a, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a significant growing body of research in the field, I think now called environmental psychology, which looks at what actually motivates people to change. And it is extremely evident that data don't. Data and science do not motivate. What motivates people is intuitional, moral, relational, spiritual, aesthetic, social, these are the motivational factors. And actually what we really need, just as you were saying, is a language that actually transcends simply the recital of facts. We've been reciting facts, as you said, for a very long time. It's not doing anything. Actually what's required is an intuitional transformation, and that's exactly why faith communities are just so important and why it's so lamentable that there's been so little action. Because these are the, faith communities are specialists in that kind of language. They are specialists in social change, they're specialists in motivational resource. And 85% of the world is a member of a faith community. So it's kind of crazy that this hasn't been activated fully. And I mean, yes, we're seeing some changes, and that I see is a good sign, but I mean, why is it so late? Why are the faith communities coming to it so late? I mean, it's a credibility issue. It's a total utter loss of credibility on the part of certainly the churches and the faith communities. So anyway, that environmental psychology really backs up what you're saying. We don't actually need more recital of science in a louder voice. We actually need a change of register.
Interestingly as well, I'm involved in a discussion next month in Birmingham for people who are involved in spiritual direction, and the idea of actually how do we help people process grief about the planet. So it's becoming more of an issue as well. Anyway, I think we've got time for one more question.
One of my perceptions as a biologist is that the issues around extinction have actually left the scientific community really struggling, because on the one hand we're seeing these massive losses of species, and there's an intrinsic value recognition of that, but at the end of the day, because of a lack of spiritual insight and perception, in the end the scientists have been forced to rely on trying to effectively bean count these things in terms of financial values. And there's a real mismatch. And you see it then, that the science falls down because the science actually isn't sound, because it's a failure to actually capture the intrinsic value. And you see that, for example, in the paper by Rockstrom, the came out some years ago that highlighted biodiversity loss globally as the thing that most threatened humans. And what was the value that they used? Rate of extinction of organisms. When you actually deconstruct that value, the organisms that are going extinct are things that humans have got practically no dependence on at all. They're amphibians and they're various rare and obscure things like them, like the cycads and so on. If we lost all of them, we wouldn't go extinct. So the problem is that the scientists haven't connected into the intrinsic value, and they're left only looking at its financial values. And I think there is a real message here for the church and for faith communities to say, actually, you've missed the trick. The reality is that we're all connected to nature. These things, irrespective of whether we need them or not, they have a value that we recognize deep down. These scientists are recognizing that value, but they can't articulate it because they can't do so in a faith way.
Want to make any further comments?
I think you're right in terms of even the extinction crisis as being something so divorced from most people's everyday life, and even the policy makers, that the questions that they're asking is, well, what proportion can we lose before things begin to unravel? And so it's almost like, well, yeah, we know it's going to happen, so what? You know, who cares? It just comes back to the question of who's Earth? Who cares? And that's what I see all the time. So, you know, I'm being asked to produce models where we do perturb an ecosystem and we lose 25% of the species, and at that point do things unravel. But on the other hand, I do find actually one of my most enjoyable moments are working with artists and musicians, and a couple of weeks ago I was invited to an event in London around the idea of rewilding, and really interesting again because you can talk to people very openly about what motivates them and why they should do that. But what I love about these ideas of using arts as well is that it is a way of connecting with people. So the challenge that I give to lots of artists is, how do we visualize complexity? And two, how might we even visualize extinctions in a way that is emotive in some way? And what I love about it is that somehow they can regain a sense of beauty and a real sense of loss for something, even though it's not something that people would encounter in their everyday lives. But they get it, and there is that sense of lament, actually. So, again, I think it is just this idea of well, I'm very much pro-science working with the arts. I don't really see the distinction, but that's another discussion. But the point is that there are ways of engaging, I think, with people in tangible ways which they can understand and will motivate them into responding.
Thank you very much. I think a round of applause is so applause for you.